Hey guys, just a quick bit about this episode. We recorded it maybe a week or two ago, and you know, we did so with the idea that like we would be having it come out around Valentine's Day, but just circumstances didn't allow for that. So it's a bit belated, and the topic is, you know, a couple weeks old at this point, but we thought it was worth a listen anyway. So yeah, just wanted to give you a heads up as to why the theme of this is a little bit out of sync with the calendar. All right, hope you enjoy. Thanks. All right, hey guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 202. I am your host, Vince. Over there is your host, Phil.
Hey.
There's Phil. In this episode, we are, albeit a few days late, talking about our favorite, and in some cases, our least favorite, romantic movies in honor of St. Valentine's Day, which just passed, and where you would have been on this sooner, but I didn't think of it until it was actually Valentine's Day, so that's why I didn't.
What is but we weren't
yeah, which is like a very guy thing to do, is like, oh my god, it's Valentine's Day, I should think of something to do. Before we start all that though, I want to remind you that Three Drinks In is available on all streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks In Pod. You can like us on Facebook, and please email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. So, did you guys do anything for Valentine's Day this year?
We ordered a pizza, and it was delicious.
We. Yeah, ours was heart-shaped.
Aww.
Yeah, no, it was actually a really big.
See, that's a scam because you're getting less pizza.
No, I think they just bent it slightly in the top, so it was the same thing. They just kind of put a little fold in the top. It was good too. We have a hard time finding pizza around here that we like, and my wife is not a big pizza fan. Like, she likes it, but like it's just like not what she would kind of go for if she would given the option. Whereas I would eat it off my shoe if I had to. But we got it, and you know, she just thought it was cute for the kids to have a heart-shaped pizza for, you know, the 4 seconds that it was there before we just took it apart and ate it. But she's like, this is really good. And I was like, it is really good. And now we have a new pizza place, which is nice. So, fun times had by all.
Yeah, well, you know, when you get to a certain age, Valentine's Day is like whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nice thing to do, I think. I think that people make a bigger deal out of the actual day. Like, I don't know why you'd ever want to go out on Valentine's. I mean, not that anyone's going anywhere, you know. I mean, pandemic or no, half the country is frozen solid right now, so it really doesn't matter. But it just seems like it's an awful thing to do, to go out to eat on Valentine's Day. Like, it's just anyone who's ever been to a restaurant and paid attention would tell you, this is a terrible idea. You should just stay home and try and order in or cook something, you know, and keep it simple. So, anyway, all right, top five romantic movies. We're also going to talk about a couple other after that. Do you want to do alternating or all in one go, or how do you want to do this?
Yeah, just do it all in one go.
All right.
Now, what's the criteria for this?
Well, I mean, it's admittedly a little loose because there are some things that are like, well, it's not quite, but like it has to be an objectively, you know, like the romance sort of has to be the main feature of it. They're like someone's relationships, you know, like there has to be the focal point of the movie. It can't be like the side hustle of the movie. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, Casablanca is a good one. It's about his relationship with what's her face. I haven't seen the movie in some time, but you know, but like movies there, like where there also is a romantic component, but it isn't the main story arc. Then, you know, that's sort of where I kind of drew the line. It could be obvious, it could be less obvious in some cases, but I think all of mine are pretty pretty spot
on. It has
on.
To be things that you've seen, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, these are all our favorite movies that involve, you know, romantic relationships, basically. Like I had Casablanca on my list, and I was like, you know, I've seen it a couple times, but not in like a decade. And I'm like, I really can't say that, like, this is my favorite, because I don't watch it a lot. You know, I meant to watch it this year. My wife got the idea to watch what was considered to be the number one romantic comedy on, I don't know, it's some list, and it was The Philadelphia Story with Cary Grant and Katherine Hepburn and Jimmy Stewart, and we watched it and promptly fell asleep because it was really, really boring. But like, some of these old films don't hold up, but they're just on lists everywhere all the time. So like, that's kind of what Casablanca was for me. It was like, yeah, it holds up, but it's like not one that I go to. Like, I'm changing channels and I go, oh look, and then I'll finish this. Unlike the other ones on my list.
Yeah, you know, it didn't even occur to me to think of that, because like, I was thinking, my mind immediately went to like romantic comedies, you know, and I was thinking more movies that like the romance was the focus.
Yeah.
And when I think of Casablanca, I don't know if that's not the first thing I think of.
Well,
I think of the
about,
Nazis.
Right. You know, that's the thing about that movie is that it's the romance is the focus of the story. However, the stuff that people remember from it is not that bit. Like, they recall "Play It Again, Sam," which he never says in the movie. He just says "Play It Again" or "Play It." You know, the whole ending, the final line, and people do recall the whole, like, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life. That's such a good line. But like, some of the funny bits, the memorable bits, they're not actually about them being gushy and romantic, because it's not the kind of character he is in most of the movie. There's some flashback scenes of them in Paris being all googly-eyed, but they're the boring parts of the movie. The good parts of the movie involve Nazis, as yeah, do most good parts of most movies involving World War II involve Nazis.
Like, he doesn't spend the movie doing the traditional things of like where he wants to be with her, because she's married at that point. So with a lot of his flashbacks to what he had with her and all that stuff. So
yeah, it's ultimately more of a story about him than about them. Which doesn't, I wouldn't see that as disqualifying in this case, because it's him in the context of their relationship. So it would still kind of fit in our somewhat loose criteria for this, but
yeah.
It makes sense if you don't think of it all the time. Side note, by the way, speaking of Nazis, I haven't said that a lot.
I feel like we've been saying it more in the last few years, though.
Yes, that is unfortunate. I'm watching the end of Band of Brothers yesterday, which I regret never having seen, because boy, was that fantastic. But the final episode, when they've won the war, there's no more fighting, and they're kind of like just rounding up what's left of Germany, and they come across a German general who, you know, gives a little speech to his men, and this guy is talking, and it's interesting because the guy is telling his German soldiers the same things that the American soldiers, you know, guys would have said to their men about this and that. And I'm looking at this guy going, where do I know this guy from? And it was the Nazi colonel from Raiders. The guy gets his face melted off at the end. You know, there's three of them. There's Belloc. There's the guy in the black trench coat, creepy guy, and then like this, like the head Nazi guy. That guy, 20 years later, is doing apparently, like, you know, he's a just very prolific, you know, German actor who just plays Nazis all the time. Which, I mean, it's your bread and butter, good for you, but what a weird thing to be your bread and butter.
Yeah. Well, that's a guy in Star Trek who always did he was always a Nazi too. Which he was like a holiday character in like several episodes, as he was some sort of Nazi character.
He just looks so airy, and you could, how could you not? You
know, like, yeah, like strong chin, you know.
You know, we have a friend, it's my wife's friend from high school, who's an actor in L.A., and he constantly gets cast as, you know, as the terrorist in something because he's got, like, this fantastic beard. And he's Jewish, but I guess he's a Sephardic Jew. He's very, very dark skin tones, and so he could look Middle Eastern. And so, like, constantly gets calls for those kind of characters.
Well, yeah, he's working.
Yeah.
All right, so what are your top five romantic movies?
Top five. Number one. This is in no real particular order. This is what kind of came to mind. Number one, of course, is When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
Sort of kind of standard. We had an argument about this, like, you know, is this a Gen X movie or is it a millennial movie? And it is definitely, I mean, I hate to consider myself a millennial in that sense because it makes me sound stupid and sort of detached, but there is a difference between somebody who was born in 1971 and somebody who was born in 1981. And I'm not sure where that line gets
about
across.
A decade or so.
About a decade worth of time. But I don't say I'm a Gen Xer because I'm really not, but I'm also not a millennial in the sense that, like, I have a memory of an analog time. And I just saw a thing on Instagram, a friend of mine from high school who did a podcast with someone that used to be a student of hers when she was a teacher. And, like, the blurb about the podcast, oh, we talked to this person about growing up in the 90s without social media. And I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah, that's... Of course,
didn't we all do that?
Right. Like, but no, like, people now grow up and have, you know, and so, like, that, you know, that memory of that pre-computer time is important, I think. But yeah, we were talking about, is this, you know, a movie that people our age would see as their go-to? And I actually don't think so. I think that, you know, the things being talked about in the film to me seem sort of strange. Like, the concept is, like, you know, can men and women be friends? Is that something that can... And when I was growing up in high school, every guy I knew had 10 girlfriends. Like, we all had friends who were girls. That wasn't an unusual thing. But at some point, before we were in high school, that was weird. Like, it just... It's one of those things where, like, I love the movie because it's just so well written and brilliantly acted and very well directed. And it's atypical for a romantic comedy in that it happens in chunks. It doesn't happen like, here's a meet cute and here's how they hate each other and here's how they get along, and then they kind of, they're forced into situations where they develop a relationship and, oh, look at that, they're in love. It's like they meet and then they leave each other and then do the same thing again. That happens like three times before the real sort of story begins. And, like, this is the sort of, and even then it doesn't have its typical track. Like, there's basically four chunks to the movie, two short ones, one long one, and then one short one again. And, you know, it, because of that unusual structure to it, it stands out amongst all the other ones. But also, I think at the time, it was kind of revolutionary to talk about some of these things as openly and as brazenly. And it was a sign of, like, okay, things are starting to change. This was 1980s. I forget what year this was. But I don't know. I just always thought it was strange that, like, they were talking about, is it possible for men and women to be friends? And I remember our dad always told us, no, it's really not. There's always, you know, so long as the people involved, you know, are attracted to the opposite, you know, to the other person's gender or whatever we call it these days, there's really always a possibility of a intimate relationship. And so, you know, this was just the first movie that kind of really openly talked about that. But to us, it was kind of a thing that was essentially true, but people wanted to ignore that fact and pretend that, no, it's fine. I can have a girl who's a friend and not worry about falling in love with her and see how that goes.
I mean, the thing with that is, I mean, I also had that on my list because it's just so funny.
It's so funny, too. 89, by the way. 89.
Yeah, it's a movie about adults.
Yeah.
Right. They're not young, which is, I mean, they're in their 30s, which if you're a high school kid, I mean, you might as well be a grandpa.
Yeah, she's 32 watching, by the time they get to the, because that great line, I'm going to be 40 when?
Right.
In 8 years.
It starts when they're in college and it ends when they're in their 30s. So you don't see them go through a lot of the things that traditional romantic comedy movie type things do, which is, you know, I'm finally ready to get out there, or I'm recovering from a breakup and I'm on the rebound and I finally meet someone different than that. Like that's just, it's not doing that formula. So the premise of the movie is explained in that first scene where they're driving to New York, where he says, you can't be friends with someone of the opposite sex. And she goes, what about all the ugly friends? He goes, no, you want to nail them too. You know, like that's the premise. And then they struggle against that the whole movie until the end, when they admit to the fact that their attraction has overwhelmed their friendship, and their attraction comes from their friendship. You know, it develops that way. So, but it's, you know, I agree. You can't be friends with these people. And when I look at my life now, I'm friends with very few single women. And the ones that are single, I don't talk to. I'm not that close with anymore. Not because I don't want to be, or because I'm afraid that they're going to jump my bones. It's because I have a partner in life. I'm married. And I spend most of my time being close and intimate with that person. Like, I don't call my friend up, my single girlfriend, and tell her about my day, because I have a wife for that, a woman I want to talk to, you know? So the idea that you can't be friends is true, because there's a level of intimacy that you can't cross. Otherwise, you're in a relationship. So,
yeah.
The
other thing,
which
about
is what happens in the, well, that's what happens in the film.
Yeah.
Like, they're friends and they tell each other everything, and they're afraid to tell each other like stuff about like sex and romance, because they realize that would be sort of crossing some sort of line, which is what ends up happening when she calls him over and says, I'm upset that this guy got married and he told me he would never do that and he just didn't want to marry me. And then they sleep together and they've crossed a line that they can't go back from. You know, so the movie ends up proving its point, which is in a funny way. So,
yeah. And,
but
you know,
I think when you're a teenager, you don't understand this concept until you're also in your 20s and 30s.
Right. Yeah. No, the movie is not for kids. And like, but like, I don't know many people my age who would look at this and go, like, you know, would make this. I don't know how this, like, when I saw it or how it ended up on my, like, how it came to, you know, my attention. But, you know, for most people my age, I think you'd have to be a little bit older than us for this to have been, you know, your go-to, you know, from when you were young enough for this to make an impression. I think you're right. Like, but like 20s, I think, is when you start to see movies like this. And, you know, in 89, I was 8 years old.
So. Yeah, no, like a lot of these things are age dependent, which is true of most movies and shows and songs and things like that.
Yeah. And I think, no, this will age like Casablanca does, though, because it will.
Well,
it's the same style or the same genre of film, but, you know, it's had a long life. It's not losing any of its charm, even though it's old.
It's like, it reminds me of American Pie, in that the themes and the subject matter it deals with are universal. You know, like when Harry Met Sally came out in 89, and it's very 80s in what they wear, what they drive. And yet what they talk about has nothing to do with the fact that it's the 80s in America. You know, it's men and women be friends at any point in time? And the same with American Pie. Was like four guys in high school who want to get laid before prom. Okay, fine. But it's not about like what do kids in the 90s have to do to get laid. It was what do boys have to do? And it's very watchable after that, even if it's the 2000s and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, even what I find funny about American Pie too is the outdated technology aspect of it. The only thing that's weird about it is like the graininess of his webcam.
Yeah.
Like nothing about that has aged poorly at all. It's, I mean, it. I always thought this was sort of a strange angle to go in that movie, with like, you know, if you don't have the balls to film a girl, how are you going to have the balls to sleep with one? That's an odd sentence. That wouldn't go over well these days. But like, as far as using the technology, that part is basically functions the same way. Everyone has the link to this, you know, video feed I'm posting. Like, how that whole thing blows up. Like, so like the hardcore technology aspect of it isn't what's aging poorly. It's just sort of like, well, you're filming somebody in your room. That's really weird, you know.
Yeah, that scene doesn't hold up quite as well.
Yeah, but although otherwise,
aside from
Jim, you're here.
Oh, Jim.
All right, so When Harry Met Sally, number one. Number two, Romeo and Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann version.
Ugh.
I know.
Still in my heart. I tried to watch it last year because I was teaching it, right, for the first time. I taught Julius Caesar to high school boys, and I said, you know what? I can't teach this anymore. I gotta switch it up. Let's do something else, and let's watch Romeo and Juliet. So I sat down one night to like watch it ahead of time so I could know what I was talking about, because I hadn't seen it in such a long time. And I think I only got like 10 minutes in, and I was like, oh, this was a waste of a DVD purchase. Like,
no,
I couldn't get through it. It was horrible.
It's not horrible. It's ridiculous. They're different.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, utterly ridiculous.
Get it? Because their guns are swords. Like,
yeah, no, but like that's, I don't know, that never bothered me. Like, you look, you have two choices. You can make something that looks like, you know, the Fellini version from the 1960s, which is so boring. Oh my God, it's so dull.
That's the version I ended up, I think I showed the, was it Fellini?
Is it Fellini? Am I making up Italian names again? Federico Fellini, is that what I'm thinking of?
That's his name?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was
just
him.
Just tell me the name of the movie you want to see.
Zeffirelli.
Zeffirelli, yeah.
The other
that's the
guy.
One I ended up
yeah,
showing that version.
Zeffirelli, yeah. It's so fucking boring. I'm sorry. It's also just so stereotypical. Like,
well,
we're doing Shakespeare.
They wanted to do, like, the Shakespeare with the costumes and the sets. Like we're making the one everyone will talk about. Yeah. And I ended up showing that version in class. And I was glad I did, because the two actors in that movie who play Romeo and Juliet are so breathtaking that even my students were like, oh, like,
yeah.
You could hear them audibly gasp when the girl came on the screen.
Yeah, they really were.
Like, see, this is why he loves her.
Two of the most attractive people walking the earth at the time. No, that's certainly true. However, I have a thing about putting Shakespeare on film. I don't generally like it. We did King Lear a little while ago, and that was interesting, but mostly because of Anthony Hopkins and because they seem to have spent a lot of money on making it look cool and modern and, you know, what have you. But, like, it's just not... It's not, it doesn't make sense as a movie for the most part, because... I mean, at least using the original text, because the text was written for specific purposes. You know, that the circumstances of the performance dictated how things were written. It wasn't just about making it sound weird and foreign and, you know, inaccessible. You know, they had little to work with, and they had to do something with it, and that's what they ended up with. So Luhrmann, what he does when he makes that movie is he just draws attention to how over the top the language needed to be in order to do what it needed to do. It needed to get the attention of the people watching it. It needed to give exposition. It needed to give, you know, the audience a sense of locations and relationships quickly and efficiently. And that's why no one talks like that. Like, the best joke in that movie, Shakespeare in Love, is when you first meet Shakespeare for the first time, and Geoffrey Rush is looking for him, and he's just, you know, Will, and then he starts speaking in iambic pentameter, and he goes, would you please talk prose? And that joke is that like, oh, that's how he talks. No one talks like that. But that's so they're telling him, snap out of it. Tell me what the hell we're doing for your next play, kind of a thing. So the fact that Lerman just took it and made it so over the top, just leaned into it completely, I thought was the absolute right thing to do. You know, quick cuts, moving the camera really fast, and you know, labeling all the, you know, the shotgun in the Montague car is called broadsword, because he says, "Hand me my broadsword," and you just kind of zoom moves over to like the label on the gun that just says broadsword, you know, 50 caliber, whatever it is. Like, it's the only way to make it work on film. That's exciting and not so dry, you know, and everyone in it is great. It's just, it's preposterous. And like the setting on, you know, in Venice Beach, I thought was good. The guy playing Mercutio from the guy from Oz, whose name I don't know, I'm sorry. It was spectacular. Yeah, this, like, you know, the slow frames and the blowing up and this over the top dramatic nonsense. Like, I just thought it was great. There's no way to do this without being ridiculous. So if you're going to be ridiculous, don't do it and be boring. Be really exciting and beat Bothellswaite, for Christ's sakes. You know, everyone in it is good except for DiCaprio and Danes. They are who they were in the 1990s. Young and, you know, relatively inexperienced and not terribly talented, but talented enough, pretty enough, you know. I don't know. I just think it's a fun, ridiculous movie that does a lot. It's also very short too, if you notice. I think it comes in like under 2 hours.
Yeah, there's a lot you can cut out of that. Yeah. Play.
Because like you've got the benefit of, you know, of it being a movie, and so you don't have to, you know, 2 hours and 10 minutes. Like for a Shakespeare play, that's like a sitcom, for Christ's sake. That's so short.
Well, you don't have scene changes, you don't have act breaks, you don't have those little scenes where characters explain the weather. You know, because there's always a scene in that, like, oh, dost thou notice that the rain? Yes, I notice it's raining out. Like, you know, you don't have to have them talk about what's happening.
Right.
Because it's a movie instead of a 3 hour thing where people are drifting off and drunk and whatever. So.
But like also like you can just take bits and pieces of what's there and mold it together into a script and not a play. And they did that with that movie. They took chunks of this and that, removed the extraneous because they could do it visually, and then, you know, just dispense with the rest. And that's, I mean, it wasn't beautiful in terms of like the language. They did butcher it a little bit.
They always
gonna do that.
The language always gets butchered in the movies because that's just a byproduct of having it shortened. You know, like the language is in the plays was. The plays were exciting at the time when, you know, in the 1400s and whatever, 1500s, because they had action and they had all that stuff. But for the higher level intellect people, let's call them, the language was what was important. And there's very few people who understand the language now. I mean, first of all, people don't speak in Elizabethan English to begin with, let alone the metaphorical kind that Shakespeare uses. So people don't care about that stuff as much. If anything, they find it annoying, you know, because every time I show it to people, they go, are they going to talk like this the whole movie? I'm like, yes, they are. That's literally the point of doing it. You know, like I could summarize the plot for you in about 2 seconds.
We are here for no other reason.
Yeah, like the language is the point, but it always gets butchered because the actors are just trying to do the plot more than the language.
Which is what you're supposed to do with movies. It's right. Movies are not
plays.
Yeah. Just like, I mean, it's the reason that I like and you hate Aaron Sorkin, because like for him the dialogue is way more important than anything. And
well, his dialogue is not any good. That's why I don't like Aaron Sorkin.
You see, I don't think it's very good. I think it's very like it it's very engaging, even though it isn't necessarily very good, because it doesn't do a lot with his scripts are not efficient. You know, that's why like movies he directs are generally not quite so great, because he's not an efficient crafter of structure. He likes to hear people talking. That's what's exciting, and like that's fun to me too. Like Mamet's like this too. So Mamet stuff is much more tight. It's so tight sometimes. It's like, you know, there's so much crammed into so few words. Just to, you know, we have to do a thing and make it sound really efficient at the same time. But I don't know. As far as like romantic movies, things like, you know, it's. I think it's fun. I think it's worth watching too. I also thought it was relatively clever, you know, the way that they accomplished certain things, the caliber of actor in it too. You have to, like, they really didn't. Everyone is in this movie. Nobody in it besides your leads, because they were cast because they were the heartthrobs of the day. But everybody else in the movie is, you know, Paul Sorvino and Brian Dennehy, Pete Postlethwaite, like I said before, and like the guy from Bring It On, what's his name? Jesse something or other. He has like a tiny role in it. Like
Paul Rudd is in it.
Paul Rudd has like a little. I was just gonna think, Paul Rudd. Like everyone in it is good. There's nobody in it who is bad. The nurse was a little over the top.
Yeah, she always is.
I didn't like the nurse. It's a tough character to play.
They always end up chopping that character up too.
Yeah.
That character is supposed to be, you know, comical and bawdy, and they always chop a lot of that out, so she just comes off as like hysterical.
Yeah, there's really no way to do that well without, like, you know, you need that sort of break in the movie somewhere to give you, you know, like get you ready for the contrast of the horrifying violence that's about to happen afterward.
Yeah.
But
like I always show Macbeth, and I mean most Shakespeare plays have this. There's always like a scene with the comedy in it to break up the like the heavy handedness. And in every version of Macbeth I've ever seen, they cut the there's a scene with like the drunken porter who opens the door for Macduff, and they always cut that character.
That's a shame.
If I could just have a second to breathe. Because that's a funny scene. Even my kids, when they read it in school, think it's funny.
It's funny, and it's also like it's so out of place.
Yeah, it's basically like another play.
Right, but
making
like
sex jokes and everything, and it's just like, where did this come from?
But it functions. It does a couple things, I think, that particular scene. One, yeah, it does what it's supposed to do, which is what your English teacher said it was to do, which is to give you a break from all the horrifying violence, just to, you know, reset for the next bit of horrifying violence. But it also is so out of place and so bawdy and so silly that it's creepy. Like, I've seen that done where, you know, the guy didn't really do much to play that up, but the contrast was so dramatic as to be disquieting. You know, like, it's if you do that right, it actually acts as foreshadowing. Like, you know, this stuff is so crazy. I'm going to make you laugh now for a few minutes before they start to eviscerate the children. You know, like, it's, yeah. Anyway, but yeah, I did like this. The nurse's scene at this, like the second scene she has when she goes to meet Romeo, is actually, I think, better, because she's standing there in like a full suit, like a pantsuit or like it's 110 degrees outside on Venice Beach, and she, you know, she's trying to get Romeo's attention, and he's trying to, you know, convince her that, you know, he really loves her, and she's so sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of stoic about it. She doesn't trust him yet, and that's a better scene for her to have, because it's cute at the same time, you know. Anyway, all right, number three, High Fidelity with John Cusack and Jack Black, a young Jack Black.
Yeah, I haven't seen this one.
So it's based on a book by a British guy whose name I can't, Nick Hornby.
Yeah, and I've read Nick Hornby, and he's a very good writer.
He's a very good writer, yeah. I actually read this. I don't think I've read anything else by him. but I read this. So it's about a about a guy in his, you know, I want to say mid-30s or so, kind of aimless. The movie begins with his breakup from like a longtime girlfriend, and he, in the process of getting over his breakup with her, you know, does a lot of direct address to camera and goes over his top five breakups of all time. And it is, John Cusack, I heard him on a podcast saying, like, this is not a movie that would get made today. Like, you can't drop in the middle of a movie that, like, oh, your main character's girlfriend had an abortion that, you know, just happens to be mentioned casually in the middle of a whole thing, and, like, he's a jerk about it, and, like, there's a whole, you know, weird aspect of it that's just, it's just 90s and gritty enough to never get made again. Like, they just don't make movies that have their main characters who are so flawed. And I think that's what I like about this movie the most, is that it's really about a guy growing, you know, a guy who, you know, breaks up, gets dumped, doesn't handle it well, does all kinds of stupid and self-destructive things, and ends up right back where he started. Because they break up for a while, he doesn't do it well, you know, he has limited contact with the ex, and he's just talking to the camera for most of the movie about, like, you know, how, you know, he views relationships and what's important, and, you know, all the decisions that he's made. And by the end of the movie, she, you know, her, like, spoilers, her father just dies. He gets a phone call and says that my dad, and she says, like, my dad died. And he goes to the funeral, and she ends up hooking up with him afterwards in a car, and just says, I want to get back together again. And you're like, what? This is just, it was just so weird. And she has this great line where she says, like, I'm just too tired not to be with you right now. And none of this should make any sense. But what the movie kind of does is it just shows you the real sort of messy way that people live their lives, and how you could make a mistake and, you know, kind of correct it by simply going back to where you started from, and then, you know, but doing it right this time. And that doesn't always really work. That's the fantasy of it. It's just like, you could really do that. You could end a relationship with somebody, you know, review all your self-destructive habits, engage in some more, and then find out that this person needed you as much as you needed them. And then you can just decide to say, we're going to try this again, but we, you know, we have to make different choices for ourselves now. And I think that was, like, the main thing about the about his character, was that he was so comfortable just doing the same thing forever, and she wasn't. And he learns about how, like, you know, a rut is a real thing, and you have to be sensitive to how you're behaving. And she says it to him in the beginning of the movie. She's like, you know, you haven't changed so much as a pair of socks since I've known you. And he doesn't see that as a problem. And so it just gives him a chance to go back with the relationship, but because that wasn't the problem. Problem was that he was in this sort of rut the whole time. And the relationship was sort of independent of that. And she says, like, I'll go back, you know, we'll get back together. And then you should do all these things to make yourself happy, because you're fucking miserable. And I've got nothing to do with that. It's just, they don't make movies like that. The movie's not, it's almost not about the relationship. It's about him and his perception of relationships. And, you know, it's a very complex thing. And I just, it's great. It's, you know, it's also really, really funny, because you have Jack Black in it. And it has one of the greatest lines one of my favorite lines in movies ever is, he's going to a club one night to hear, what's the name? Can't think of the actress's name, but it's like a singer, and she goes to a club, and he gets to the door, and she's doing "Baby, I Love Your Way" by Peter Frampton, but she's, like, doing a cover of it, and he's, like, not even in the club, and he just takes one foot in, looks at the bouncer, and goes, "Is that Peter fucking Frampton?" And the guy just kind of slow nods, like, "Yup." It's just the greatest thing. This is a weird line. Like, is that Peter fucking Frampton? So yeah, no, it's
well,
great.
I mean, he works at the music store, doesn't he?
Right. I mean, the
I mean, that's a big part of the thing is that he works in this rundown, crappy music store, and the music is really important to his life.
Right. So that's I mean that the way in which this is his, you know, life is designed and how he broaches the, you know, people and how like just gets into people is that, you know, he runs a record store in Chicago, and like for the snobbiest of the music snobs, like they just sell records, they don't really sell CDs, kind of a thing.
Yeah, like he's a jerk about it.
Oh yeah, total snob. I mean, that's like they're, you know, and there's then they talk about it in these great scenes about like, you know, top five this and top five that, and they go through and yeah, but like music is a big part of the movie, and it's, you know, it sort of shapes his personality in terms of like it's more important what you like than who you than what you're like, kind of a thing. But yeah, no, it's a great movie. All right, moving right along. Number four, 10 Things I Hate About You. Again, it's more Shakespeare, which is nice. So, yeah, this was like, I was trying to think of like all those 90s romantic comedy type, you know, like American Pie, and there was a whole Down to You, and what was the other one? Like Summer Catch, like all these, I mean, all these really.
Oh, there's a million of them.
But they were so prevalent back then. That's when, like, you know, stars really, these like young stars were making all these movies. And this is the only one I think that really sort of continues to work, because it's Shakespeare. Because it's you know, this the story is, again, it's so primal to be timeless, and you know everybody in it is great. Even Julia Stiles, who never really, you know, and Larissa Olenek, who we never saw again after this. And, you know, but then, you know, you have Heath Ledger and David Krumholtz and whoever played the dad. I can't think of his goddamn name right now.
Oh, I can't think of his name, but he was very good.
Yeah, you know, he's great. I mean, like, the you know, you had... You know, you had stories, you had good actors, you had a lot of well-written lines, you had a ton of scene stealing. Like, everybody has their moment in this movie. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, for Christ's sakes.
You know? This was his big one after, like, Third Rock from the Sun.
Third Rock from the Sun, yeah. So, like, yeah, it just, it's also shot really well, too. I don't know, I forget who directed it, or if I ever knew. But like they filmed it in Seattle at this amazing high school, which is an actual high school in Seattle, and they just took full advantage of their helicopter budget, and they just did a lot of,
yes,
you know, like the opening scene from the movie is like an aerial tour of this suburb of Seattle, and I don't know how they did this, but like the, I guess they transferred to a crane because this is before drones. Now you can do whatever you want with a drone, but you know there's a handoff between like this sweeping. I think it was a shot with a helicopter to like a crane, and it comes right into the window, and it just the movie just kind of flows. Like there's interesting enough camera work. You know, the scene where he sings the Four Seasons on the steps of the. Like the outdoor stadium and the whole thing, and it was a large movie that was about a very small thing. Like it was good. No, it's a classic movie, I think. Your thoughts?
I also had that one on my list. So,
oh, okay. Well, we'll let you talk about it more of that later if you want.
Yeah.
Okay then.
Okay, and then what's the last one?
Tangled.
I had not thought to put any Disney movies on there.
Yeah, I kind of went through and, you know, my daughter, who's not even two yet, really likes The Little Mermaid. And I think that might be, musically speaking, my favorite Disney movie. It's a tie between that and Aladdin. It's sort of hard. I think the songs in Aladdin, you know, they were, most of them were written by Howard Ashman and let's see, what's the other guy? Oh God. Oh, my wife's gonna kill me. Oh,
Tim Rice did the other ones, right?
Is it no? Shit, I'll look it up. But it's gonna drive me absolutely crazy. Howard Ashman and Alan Menken. That's what it was.
Alan Menken, right?
Yeah. Oof. But so like they did Mermaid, and that was them completely, and then he got sick after that, and so like there was songs of his from Aladdin, songs of his in Beauty and the Beast, and but you know, Mermaid was like there, and it's just such a perfect little musical, you know, put on to cellulose that it's you know, it's great. However, like, it's got a very sort of standard Disney, you know, fall in love thing for no good reason. Like, there's no relationship development in that movie. There's the mermaid is in love with the guy because she is.
Yeah, like, I think that's why I wouldn't have thought of any of them, because like those movies are all focused very much on the one character, and the other character, like the love interest, tends to be like not paper thin, but all of them. I mean, like some of them have a little bit more, but most of them don't have anything. And like, you're right. Like in The Mermaid, she falls in love with the guy because he's extremely handsome. I mean, everyone else is drawn like a ridiculous caricature, but you know, she falls in love with him. And then when she gets to know him, she can't talk. So he doesn't really know her. you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to turn my back on my entire family and way of life to marry this guy with the big puffy shoulder sleeve wedding dress that was so popular in the 80s. It's painful to look at. It's the only thing I can think of when I think of that movie.
Yeah, it sort of stands out. But Tangled isn't like that. Tangled, the two characters begin on equal footing. It's sort of a, you know, it's a very standard sort of meet cute thing, and except she hits him with the frying pan. You can do things with these characters because they're cartoons that you couldn't do. You couldn't, you know, she couldn't hit him with a frying pan in real life. That would be insane. She would have killed him four times. So like, they're two independent characters that have independent goals, and they have to work together to overcome them, and their adventure makes them fall in love. That's like
I read the behind the scenes things about it, and when they were coming up with it, it was just going to be her, and then they said like, well, that's stupid. Like we should, if she's going to go out with some guy, then he has to be interesting enough to help carry some of it. And they said, so they ended up spending more time on him. And the next thing you know, the movie was about him. And they're like, okay, well, now we've gone too far because it's supposed to be about her. And so they kept going back and forth until the next thing you know, like they had both characters being like ridiculously interesting with backstories and songs and everything. And they were like, all right, well, this works too. Like, we'll just have the movie be about the both of them. Because, and that's why they changed it from like Rapunzel. I mean, they were also trying to market it towards boys and not just girls, but it worked. They're like, it's not just about Rapunzel anymore. Now it's about him. So, you know, it works better this way. Adding to him made her a better character and vice versa.
Right.
You know, which doesn't really happen in most Disney cartoons, especially in the earlier ones.
It was surprisingly sophisticated.
I love Tangled.
So, I know.
Like I had a Tangled wedding cake topper, for God's sakes.
That's true. You forget about that. Yeah, and like I think too that the independent of the love story aspect, like the movie benefits from the fact that both of their leads are singers. That doesn't happen very often.
Well, that was a conscious decision they made, and they've done that in most of the movies since.
Have
where they?
They
were like,
yeah, I guess that's true.
We want to hire like people. Too. Frozen's like that. Moana's like that. We want to hire people who can also do the singing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as important to get gimmicky guest characters as our cartoon voices as it became in the late 90s. You know, after Robin Williams did the genie. And then it became like, well, let's just get people to do the voices. Who cares if they can sing? We can pay an extra guy to sing the songs, you know?
Yeah.
But they were getting people who weren't voice actors. So, like, it was easier to train a singer to be a voice actor than it was to make a voice actor be a singer.
Yeah, definitely. So. Yeah. There was that great documentary about it. I Know That Voice that John DiMaggio did, talking about how, like, basically after Aladdin, the industry just basically exploded, it dissolved. She had all these guys who were doing, you know, cartoon work, couldn't get a job, even doing commercials, because, you know.
I still hear Donald Sutherland selling me Hidden Valley or orange juice or something.
It's become like a fun thing, and I don't watch commercials anymore because I haven't really watched network TV or even TV with commercials in ages. But like every so often I'll hear an ad, and like I'll know exactly, like Josh Lucas, the guy from Ford versus Ferrari, I think it's Leo Beebe was the character's name. Kind of stuck in my head. He's the Home Depot ad guy. There is no reason that I can think of why you would need to hire this guy who had a career 15 years ago, vanished for a while, and then reappeared in Ford versus Ferrari. Why you have to hire him to do your voice act, to do your voiceover work for the Home Depot? There's got to be a voice actor out there who would cost half as much, at least, as this guy. But I have no idea. I mean, it might be, not being an expert in this, something primal in people's heads that, like, you know, you just recognize certain voices, and so you're sort of more drawn to it. Is it just that you're trying to play guess whose voice that is, or is it like, you know, something in like that subconscious unknown thing where it's like, well, you know, that voice sounds familiar, I'll pay attention to this this ad for the two. I don't know, but it works. So
yeah.
Anyway, so that's, yeah, that's my five. Tangled.
Cool.
All right, you're up.
Well, luckily mine are short because two of them were the same. Like I had When Harry Met Sally, and I had 10 Things I Hate About You. Okay, moving along. I have it on a post-it note here, sorry. Number three for me was Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
About the kid trying to get the letter to the girl who just broke up with her, as the French say, douchey boyfriend. On like the big party night, like after senior year, so the whole movie takes place at that party, in that house, and I just thought it was great. It's very funny.
Yeah, like there was a whole bunch of those that like 1998 through 2000, like those kind of nostalgic type movies, and 10 Things wasn't really that, but like, you know, it still featured a lot of young actors doing all.
I mean, there were 1,000 teen movies in the 90s about people getting together, and like I could have picked any one of them. You know, I mean, I could have picked She's All That or Cruel Intentions or whatever. But all of them felt so fake. I mean, like, She's All That. Like, they take her glasses off and take her hair out of a ponytail. And like, oh, my God, she's prom queen. You
she's
know?
Superman.
Like, yeah, like, it was so stupid. But Can't Hardly Wait is goofy on purpose. Like, he's trying to confess his love to this girl while this wackiness is going on all around him. And all of that is just basically exaggerated versions of what happens when you finish high school, you know?
And in some cases, not that exaggerated.
And yeah, and in some cases, I mean, like the geeks were super geeky and like the band that doesn't actually play any music and they trash the house. But all the emotional stakes were very real.
A love burger. Well done. That movie is the king of the one-liners. Like, there's just so many single lines in that movie that are just so memorable.
Yeah, like it. But the emotional stakes are all very real. So like, you have him trying to confess his love to her. You're trying to her trying to figure out what her identity is when she's not with somebody. You have Seth Green's character up in the bathroom with the loner girl who no one talks to.
There's no way, there's no reason that should have worked. There's just not. Like, I knew guys like that in high school. These are all the guys I went to high school with. There's no way that that character should work. But it works. It's so freaking hilarious.
Which one? Seth Green?
Seth Green. It's so over the top. Like, it's almost a parody of parody. It's just...
Like deep down, all of those characters felt real because they were cover, like the real ones were covering for how they really felt. Because like he's acting like he's this black gangster. He's 4 feet tall, white kid with spiky hair and goggles on. But like when they talk to each other because they're locked in the bathroom, and he speaks like a normal human, and he says, like, clearly I'm overcompensating. Like, I'm nervous. I'm shy. I've never been with a girl. I don't know how to act as myself. Like, that's something everyone can relate to.
Yeah.
So, on top of the one-liners, I thought it's a great movie.
Yeah.
So I picked that one.
Yeah. I mean, I think there really only are three that are worth anything from that whole mess of a genre that just got, they just cranked them out like a machine. I think it's 10 Things. I think it's Can't Hardly Wait. I think it's American Pie. Like, they're really, those are the three best ones. And you can argue which one of those three are the best of them, but you'd be there for a while. The rest of them are clearly not as good as those three. Those three were the...
Yeah, and I was talking to my wife because she
and they're all different too. If you know, like they're not the same movie. Like one is Shakespeare, one is that one night where it's focused on 20 different characters, and then one is just these four friends. They're all very different stories.
That's why I was talking to my wife, and she watches far more of these than I do. And I was saying, like, should I go back and look at like the 80s movies with The Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink and Say Anything, and I didn't, because those movies were very much of the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't see them, but and they didn't feel quite as real to me. Even like Dirty Dancing, I was just like, eh.
I've never seen that movie.
I've seen bits of it. It's okay. I wouldn't watch it again. It was good. I wouldn't do it over, but
I wouldn't watch it again.
I mean, it's just me. I tend to prefer movies that are funny. So like,
sorry,
I don't sit at home watching This Is Us. I'm not that kind of guy. So,
yeah.
Anyway,
moving on.
Number four, I have Kissing Jessica Stein.
Oh, a bit of an indie film.
Yes, I enjoy that film.
I am not familiar. I mean, I've heard of it, but that's about it.
It's about a girl who has miserable relationships with men, and she strikes up a friendship with a girl, and they end up dating. And it's like later in life. She's like in her late 20s, later in life, like her late 20s, where she's like desperate to find a man and marry. And so she ends up going out with a woman instead. And it's all about how, you're not quite sure what you're looking for. And it's like, if you're really that lost, how far are you willing to go to find somebody and go outside of your comfort zone and examine what you really want in a partner, which is really interesting. And you're right. It's definitely an indie movie that, no budget, no one you've ever heard of. Maybe they spent the money on like music a little bit, but it was not like a big winner or anything.
2001. I'm just kind of looking it up now.
Yeah, 2001.
Yeah, no one I've heard of. Interesting.
Yeah, I think the guy from what's his name? Mad Men. John Hamm, I think, is in it for like half a second or something.
Really?
Yeah, but there's nobody super famous or anything.
He doesn't even crack like the thing, before you get to, see full cast on IMDb. Mm. Here he is, John Hamm. Yeah. Hilarious. He was working a long time before he became famous.
I mean, he's very good looking.
So. Yeah, say the least.
So, yeah, I always liked that. I thought it was interesting. Well acted. So.
Yeah. So it was written by the woman that played the, it was written by the woman that plays the main character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As most of these indie films tend to be.
Yeah.
You know.
Interesting. Directed by, can't find that.
Charles Herman Wormfeld.
Yeah, not familiar.
Yeah. He did Legally Blonde 2.
What was the subtitle of that one? Legally Blonde 2, back in something.
Red, White, and Blonde, isn't it?
Okay, yeah. I don't even know what that means.
I don't ask those kind of questions anymore. What do the subtitles mean? Yeah. But I recommend it if you can find it anywhere streaming. I would recommend that movie.
Nice.
Yep. And my last one is Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Oh.
Jason Segel.
That's a good one. Kind of a newer movie compared to these other ones.
Yeah. That's more that's one that I can watch no matter where I find it on TV. I'll watch the whole thing. You know, because who can't relate to being a giant man child and realizing that you go through a bad breakup, even though as you mature and get a little bit wiser, you realize it wasn't good, you know, and it wasn't because he was a bad guy or she was unfaithful and a jerk, you know, although she was a little bit, but they weren't a good fit. And he tries to convince himself that they were for most of the movie. And it takes a lot for him to sort of get out of his shell and examine everything, which is not something that they show people doing. So in High Fidelity, I guess they do that, and he doesn't have any epiphany at the end. But in this movie, he does, but it's gradual, and you see it in flashback, where he'll look back at his life and be like, I wore all these awful clothes that she used to buy me for holidays, and she never even noticed. Or she would go to my stupid shows that I would put on to be nice. And I thought she actually liked going, you know, they weren't a good fit for one another. They were forcing it.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't usually happen. And it's nice to see that he was the man. He was the guy who was so upset. You know, usually it's the woman who breaks down when she gets broken up with. But here it's he can't go through a whole scene without drinking or crying.
Yeah. Know? No, it's a picture of somebody really not taking care of themselves after a breakup.
Yeah. Plus Hawaii's nice to look at. So.
Yeah, not an accident. Hey, you know, we can shoot this thing in Hawaii if you'd like. Well, okay, let's go do that.
Well, okay then. Yeah,
yeah, no, High Fidelity and that movie do have a lot in common. The end result is different. I mean, Peter in Forgetting Sarah Marshall does, you know, he finds a completely different path to go on. But, you know, whereas, the John Cusack character ends up back where he started. But the journey really is about looking at themselves. And not about the relationships that they were in. The relationship was important, but only as sort of a portal into looking into the decisions that they're making and saying, am I doing these things for the right reason? Does this make any sense? Are they related to each other? Is the stuff I'm doing related to my partner? Is it not? And I think that was the most important thing about, and it's a scene that comes much later in the movie where they reconnect, him and the ex-girlfriend, and they, she just breaks down and yells at him for the first time and says, no, you did all these, it was hard to be with you. You are not an easy person to love. And it's sort of a real punch in the dick, because that whole time you're very sympathetic towards him because he's the one who's the sad sack, and she's the one that's cheated on him with, you know, the hilarious Russell Brand, who I thought was absolutely again, yeah, all the side good. People in this movie, Paul Rudd again, you know.
Paul Rudd. I always liked it because she's vacationing with Russell Brand in the same place he's vacationing, and him and Russell Brand get along.
Yeah.
even though that they're together, you know, and because like he's like, you know, you're cool, you're a famous musician, you know, you're fun to talk to. Like, I don't stand a chance, but it's not like jealousy. It's just like, she should be with a guy like you because, you know, it wasn't working with me. I'm not you and I never could be. Like, there's no jealousy because there's no shot that Jason Segel can compete with this guy, you know, like it's supposed to be driven home that Jason Segel is this emotional sad sack who likes to talk about his feelings kind of character, you know?
Yeah.
They don't usually see that, so.
No. It's an unusual film.
Yeah.
Also, well, the full frontal male nudity.
Oh, yeah.
Which I believe is based on a true story, because Jason Segel wrote the movie. Yeah, he said, like, he broke up with a guy, he got dumped with it while he was naked, and I thought that was great. Like, he, like, refuses to put clothes on.
Yeah, he's like, so upset he won't put his pants on.
Well, he says, like, if I break up, if I put clothes back on, it's over. And I'm like, that's really funny, because that's probably true. Like, once you put on your clothes, that is the end of the relationship. So, all right, nice.
All right, so what is the one that you hate the most that you've seen?
All right, so the romantic movie that I hate the most is 500 Days of Summer.
Oh, I have not seen this one.
Oh, my God. So, all right, for those of you who don't know, this is Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Zoe Deschanel. And it's about this guy, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who he works for a greeting card company, which I thought was kind of interesting. Like, you know, it's his job to come up with fun and, you know, clever greeting cards. And he meets this girl whose name is Summer. And his whole thing is that I haven't seen this in like 10 years, but I believe like his character is pretty like open to being in relationships. He's eager to be in one. He's not like the kind of guy that he's not like a douchey guy, you know, runs around, does whatever. And you know, he meets this girl. He wants to date her. He played by, of course, Zoe Deschanel. And she basically says to him, I don't want to date you. I don't want to be in a relationship with you. You know, that's not what I'm interested in, but I will, you know, we can be like it's not entirely clear what kind of relationship that she wants, but basically they run around and have fun together, and there's cute scenes of them playing in IKEA, and they're, you know, they're you know, just doing all the cute romantic things that couples do, and they're having sex, and they're basically in a relationship. And then at some point she breaks up with him, and the movie is about him getting over the relationship. And he had been with her for like 500 days. And so it's him recounting his relationship and the way in which he sort of, you know, self-destructively gets over the breakup from her. And the reason I hate this movie is because it perpetuates the idea that it is healthy and normal to turn to somebody and say to them, I don't want to date you formally, but I will, you know, have sex with you and go on dates with you and behave in such a way that is dating. But we're not going to, it's like, you know, it sort of normalizes the leaving yourself an out thing. You're basically in an open relationship, and he takes advantage of her.
It's not very progressive of you.
Sorry. she takes advantage of him.
Right.
And, you know, like, I was so blinded by rage for the whole thing that I'm missing some things here, but that was sort of the gist of it. And, like, you're basically supposed to, you know, feel sorry for him, but not because she was awful to him, even though she was awful to him. And it's just sort of this thing that hangs over the movie where it's just like, you're supposed to feel sympathy for him, But you're also supposed to look at what she does as going, no, that's okay. She can do that. It's his fault for getting himself too emotionally invested in this relationship when she wasn't, because she made it clear from the beginning that she didn't want that kind of relationship. And I was just, I sat there and I watched it and I went, this is the most dishonest piece of crap I've ever seen.
Get that stuff in writing, my friend.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, and I can't imagine the number of young women who saw that and went, oh, you mean I can do that? Great. Let's do that, because that's a lot less emotionally, you know, risky than doing anything else. And it was just it was just weird to me to see such a giant blind spot, because she's the same from beginning to end. She never changed. He goes through this entire emotional roller coaster. He's basically a meat grinder for his emotions that he comes out the other end on. You know, I mean, like the beginning of the movie, he's like breaking plates, and like his little sister shows up, who's like a kid, to try to snap him out of it, to get him, you know, to figure out how to deal with this awful breakup he's had. And she's never affected by it emotionally whatsoever.
I just saw something. Sorry.
No. Like, I never liked Zooey Deschanel, and I'm pretty sure it's because she's a robot. Like, I've never seen her do any kind of...
Oh, that's right. She's the girl.
Yeah. I've never seen her do any kind of emotion acting thing ever. She just kind of stands there and looks cute and, like, twists her head from, like, you guys can't see me, but, like, kind of cocks it from side to side. And I have bangs and big blue eyes, and, like, that's all she does. That's all she does in this movie too, and it was just so infuriating. Like, we're missing a whole piece of, you know, what it is to be a responsible human being in a relationship. You've ignored it, and it pissed me off. It still does, to no end. And I think at the time, my wife, who was then my girlfriend, was just. And I was like, that's awful. She just treated him like shit for 2 hours, and we had to watch it. Like, I was like, well, she told him she didn't want to be. I'm like, that she also slept with him and like did all these other things. Like, they, you know,
it doesn't got a little mixed.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things where like it doesn't matter what you call if it. You know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck and swims like a duck, guess what the fuck it is.
Yeah.
So it just. Something about that really. So it wasn't like a badly made movie, but the central conceit of it, I thought, was so shallow and misguided, and trying to be a progressive type of romantic comedy, where it's like it's up to the guy not to, you know, do the thing that girls used to do, which is to fall in love with someone who didn't love them back, and like there is something to that. Like he definitely does not. You know, look at the situation honestly. He sees what he wants to see in the movie. And, you know, it ends up destroying him for a time. But the fact that there's no point, that at least that I can recall, where any of her behavior, she's never self-critical of her own choices. She never looks at what he says and says, like, yeah, I guess I can see how I've led you on for the last 500 days. You know, there's never any of that. The movie is his fault, you know, and that's an odd choice, you know, to have kind of a one-sided romantic comedy. And yeah, so that's my one I can't stand. What was yours?
The one I hate the most, and there's a million of them I don't like, but I picked this one just to narrow it down, was How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Not 9, not 11, but 10.
So I just saw a thing today on YouTube. It was a clip from the Graham Norton show, which I really love that show. I've just seen clips of it, but it's the funniest stuff on YouTube. Apparently, that movie's poster started the Matthew McConaughey lean. Like
he's leaning against her in the picture.
Yeah, like the two of them are kind of like they make a little triangle, like they lean into each other, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how after that movie, every poster that he was on, he was leaning into something. And like there was one I think with I can't think of oh, they showed you one, and then the other one was with him and Sarah Jessica Parker, where like he was basically falling backwards, and you know she was propping him up, and they made a joke about how, you know, even at his Dallas Buyers Club weight, he would have crushed her like an egg, which I thought was really funny. Anyway, so you were saying about How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
I hate this movie. Like, I hate it so much. There's this thing with these movies where, especially in the 90s, you know, in a way to get them, the man and the women on these, on this path where they're going to have conflicts, their careers are always a big part of it, you know, like, she's a wedding planner, or on a, you know, an event planner, and
he's the groom.
He's the groom.
It's called the wedding planner.
You know, if you've ever seen that one, he's a greeting card maker or what have you. You know, and their jobs are always, it becomes a thing between my job and my love life, and there's this push and this pull, and they're never quite happy with what they do, and they either get pulled out of it by the spouse or whatever, or they find a new passion for what they're doing now and all that stuff. And in this movie, she works for a magazine and she's like trying to pitch, you know, doing a story about like war orphans and conflict in the Middle East and all this stuff.
Yeah, she works for like Vogue.
She's not allowed to because she works for Vogue. And her editorial assistant is like, maybe don't pitch that. And she pitches it. And her editor goes, we're a shoe magazine or whatever. Like, we don't do stories about the Khmer Rouge and things like that. Like, it's not what we do here. And they tell her to come up with it. You know. She's like, well, if I do this stupid story about men and how to loot, like, how could I dump a guy? Will you let me do my war story? And they're like, I'll think about it. It's like B.B. Newworth or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, the conceit was that the pitch was that she would do all the things that girls shouldn't do in relationships that cause them to get dumped.
Right.
And yeah. his angle was he was doing the opposite.
He was trying to win a bet where he could get her to fall in love with him by doing the things girls want. So they were going at each other in opposite directions. But so they fall in love for no reason. So whatever. I just could not wrap my mind around the fact that they had taken that work, you know, professional conceit and snapped it over someone's knee. Like, no one's that stupid to think you can run a story like that at a magazine for fashion and boys. Like, I just couldn't get my brain around that concept. So like 20 minutes in, I'm like, she should be in an insane asylum. Like, this is not how people behave. I hated it so much.
And it made $125 million.
And then when she finds out that he's doing this thing for a bet, she like throws it in his face. You know, like, how could you
I remember that.
Sleep with me because you're trying to win a bet? And he's like, you're going to publish an article about me. Like, she made his life hell.
Yeah.
Like the stupid stunts that she pulled, and yet he still falls in love with her. It's like, this is just horse shit.
Yeah, I remember watching that movie, and there were weird things about it. Like, so she basically is bipolar in the film. Essentially, she has, like, you know, it was just a barely written movie. She's got her serious journalistic side of her, even though she works at Marie Claire or whatever the hell it is. Like, I mean, Vogue might even do a thing on the Khmer Rouge. What definitely wouldn't, you know, because I mean, nowadays teen Vogue will do things about all kinds of stuff that you would never think of. But like, what's like the most basic Red Book? She works for Red Book, for Christ's sakes. And so she has serious journalistic side of her. She has, you know, this persona that she invents to trap this guy to then torture him basically for 10 days. And then like there's a scene where I thought this was great. He's from Staten Island. Now, I've been to Staten Island. Nobody on Staten Island looks like Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. Matthew McConaughey is as corn-fed as you get. He's just, you know, chiseled out of maize, that man is. You know, so like, oh, no, we're going to go visit my family on Staten Island. And they must be in the mafia because they have a house on the water in Staten Island, which that exists.
Yeah, sailing or whatever.
Yeah, no, like, they have this ridiculous house on Staten Island, you know, like, it's not in the dump. That's the most important thing about their house. And then she just behaves normally, like she's in a real relationship with this guy. And it was just, she was remarkably schizophrenic as a character. And he's not. Like, he's sort of singularly focused on, you know, whatever it is his job is, and then, you know, winning the bet to get this girl. But yeah, like, I think ultimately what really pissed me off was the same thing as you, was that, like, at some point, her behavior is simply just not, you know, like, she's more upset at him than he is at her, even though what she does is essentially worse, you know, in a way. I don't know. It's sort of hard to say, like, what's worse, trying to bed someone for a bet or, you know, trying to, you know, emotionally manipulate somebody for a week and a half just so you could advance your career. I mean, it's a toss up, I have to say. But the response to it that I recall was that she gets mad at him and he's like, "What the hell?" And then not much happens to her in this story. She just like, yeah.
Right, yeah. She comes out pretty quick, and then she ends up, like, you know, quitting the magazine and getting a real job,
goes to work for the New York Times. Like, what were you doing there to begin with, and what exactly was stopping you from doing that from before? I don't know.
So yeah, I hate that one.
That's not a good one, but it's interesting that, like, that's the thing that you caught that really pissed you off in that movie. And this is sort of kind of like the thing about 500 Days of Summer. Like, there are lots of bad romantic comedies or, you know, sort of like, you know, romantic dramas. But, you know, the thing that makes the good ones good is the sort of equilibrium of the parties involved. You know, like Tangled becomes equally about Rapunzel and Flynn. When Harry Met Sally, they're both, you know, sort of messed up people kind of fumbling through life on their own. You know, High Fidelity, it's just, you know, it's not even about the relationship. It's about him, you know, trying to manage, you know, himself within the world of people around him. They're all sort of real stories about people. But, like, when you tell a story, you know, that's been through the marketing room before it got to the writer's room. Like, there's got to be someone that says the girl can't be wrong, because that's your target audience for these movies. It's basically women. And, you know, men will go see them too. We saw these movies. That's why we can talk about them. But, you know, we may have even wanted to see them, although I don't think I would have wanted to see How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days on my own. But there must be a thing. It's just like, you know, the outrage about what the guy does has to be greater than the outrage about what the girl does. And that just, maybe that's just us. It's just going to sit bad with us. But it also makes for really lopsided storytelling. It just makes things seem, you know,
it doesn't feel believable that way, you know, like, because...
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah, obviously, and sometimes there's a guy who's a jerk. Yeah, sure, but when you get both sides of it, it tends to be more realistic, and you see how there is communication and expectations can be different. But if you only get the one side, it's like, if you're the side that's the bad side, like, usually it's the man who's the idiot, then I can't help but feel personally attacked. So.
Well, yeah, that's sort of what it is. Like, I know lots of people who are in relationships similar to the one in 500 Days of Summer. The realism part of it isn't that much of a stretch to me. It's just unpleasant to watch. And any, you know, The conclusion of that movie is that he gets over the breakup and he meets somebody new. This is also a realistic thing to do. He meets, by the way, I think Minka Kelly, who dated Derek Jeter for a while, who I always thought was absolutely gorgeous and way prettier than Zooey Deschanel. But the realism thing is in there. It's just that, like, it's just not that interesting. Like, if you know, realism in romantic comedies is not hard to come by. There's lots of dysfunction and coincidence in real life that could make a decent, you know, romantic movie. But what's interesting is when you can take a look at how people interact with each other on film and tell a story in a different way. And I think that's what When Harry Met Sally does. I think that's what, you know, 10 Things is not new, but it's certainly, you know, it's sort of classic, and they were able to translate that, you know, the Taming of the Shrew very easily into a modern way of telling a story. But like Tangled is a new take on an old fairy tale. High Fidelity was definitely, you know, again, it's an unusual kind of movie. Kissing Jessica Stein, definitely, like, you know, a new way, certainly at the time too, you know, 2001, a new way to tell stories about relationships. Like, these things, they're pedestrian after a while, and it's, you know, it's boring. And it reinforces a lot of stuff about people's relationships that it's too common to be interesting. And it's also unpleasant to watch at the same time. So yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right, that's all of the movies. Now, did you want to still talk about The Princess Bride?
We don't really have time now because we've kind of gone long here. I'm looking to sort of double check in our Instagram story that you know, I had asked some people, like, "Oh, did you have any you know, things that they want to share?" But I can't figure out how to get to that. You know. Like, look at my old story, my archive. Maybe it's in my archive. Anyone actually ask a question? Nobody did. Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate that. I just asked, you know, if, you know, you know, if you had any thoughts about, you know, your maybe it didn't publish. I don't know. Anyway, but I asked people for, like, you know, what's their, you know, favorite types of these movies. So I didn't actually get any responses, and if I find them, I'll mention it next week. But anyway, that was that. Okay. But yeah, The Princess Bride. My basic point was that it was kind of overrated.
Yeah.
But that's sort of, we can get into that at a later date. It's good. It's just, it's overrated. Anyway, but yeah, that's it. So if you guys out there have any thoughts about your favorite romantic movies or something maybe that you watched for the first time this Valentine's Day, you can let us know on Twitter or Instagram. We are at Three Drinks In Pod. You can find us on Facebook. You can email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio, or really wherever you listen, to subscribe and tell your friends about us and leave reviews. Positive ones. At least just the 5-star rating would be great. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. As always, please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you next time.
Yep. Take care.
Bye.